From our studios around the world, this is Eat Well, Travel Better, the Business of Food Travel podcast. Every month, we bring you the world's culinary tourism industry professionals and share with you strategies, tactics, and information that help make you a more effective leader, communicator, and professional in our culinary tourism industry. I'm your host, Eric Wolf. Thanks for listening. Welcome to episode 51. Today, we will be speaking with Sumaya Hamdi. Described as the entrepreneur redefining travel for millennial Muslims, Sumaya is the founder and managing director of the Halal Travel Guide, a travel company focusing on creating better travel experiences for Muslims. Halal Travel Guide works in partnership with local hosts from around the world to design trips with adventure-seeking Muslims in mind and provides free digital travel guides to help Muslims plan better independent trips. Sumaya, it's so nice to be chatting with you again. I think it was last year that you and Yvonne appeared on our Food Travel Talk TV, and we had a really interesting conversation. What have you been working on since we last spoke to you?
Well, thank you very much, Eric, for having me back. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. I feel like we're very much kindred spirits when we get together and talk about travel and food. So yeah, it's been a little while. And since then, thankfully, travel has started to open up quite a lot. So I've been pretty busy hosting guests. We managed to restart Halal Travel Guide tours in summer of 2021. And since then, we've taken guests to Bosnia, we've taken guests to Jordan, and we recently concluded the first ever international Muslim-friendly trip to Barbados.
Nice. Wow. Barbados is a wonderful destination. Did you visit the hot sauce store there?
Oh, the hot sauce store. No, I don't think we did, to be honest. I know that every single guest took a bottle of hot sauce home. I'm not that much of a hot sauce fiend, but I definitely noticed that everyone was really hot on the hot sauce.
Well, I imagine there's more than one hot sauce store there, but it is the Scotch bonnet peppers that are so prevalent throughout the Caribbean. And you find them in a lot of different hot sauces, and I can't take much of that heat.
I mean, we really enjoyed the food in Barbados. We had, you know, because one of the most wonderful things about traveling, of course, is trying different foods and different ways of cooking familiar foods. And we were really lucky in that we had a local partner take us around and give us a really nice variety, because there's quite a fusion of, you could say, kind of this Caribbean influence. And then you've also got the South Asian influence coming in there. So it's a fascinating fusion of island life and then South Asia.
It is very much so. Did you visit what's the night market area called?
Oystons.
Oystons, yes. Did you visit that area?
Yes, of course. We paid a visit to Uncle George. Uncle George, I think, is one of the most popular. It's not like a restaurant. I guess it's kind of like a, I don't know how you describe it. But anyway, he does amazing macaroni pie. So good. I think we ate, what was it? It wasn't marlin. I forget. I think we had swordfish, to be honest. I think we had swordfish, macaroni pie, rice and peas. Seriously good, you know, like cooked out on that open fire, barbecued and grilled really nicely. And just, it wasn't as live as it was pre-pandemic, but obviously that's because Barbados is only just opening up again. And when we went, it was end of January, they had only just removed the curfew. So Oystons is pretty famous for being really loud and having a really great vibe. But I think that'll start to pick up quite soon. But the food was just as good as it always is, because it's my second trip to Barbados and the food was really good.
Okay. Well, you're quite brave scheduling trips right now when the pandemic is not quite over, because I think you said you went in January, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And we were still not really sure the direction the pandemic was headed in. There's still plenty of vaccine passports required and quarantines and so on. What was it like? I mean, you know, were you nervous that the trip would be canceled?
Definitely nervous. I think in December, when the Omicron variant came about, there was definitely a lot of nervousness. And we saw that as well with countries being closed off and borders closing. So at the start of December, we were sort of really nervous about going ahead with any trips, and we had actually had a Jordan trip scheduled for the end of December, but I kept an eye on restrictions, and sure enough, no further restrictions were made. And actually the countries that had been placed on what we call the red list here in the UK were quite quickly taken off, and so we were actually able to go ahead with the trip in Jordan at the end of December, despite the fears that Omicron would further disrupt travel. I think we're in a very good position. I have to say that we're very fortunate here in the UK and in a lot of Western countries that there have been vaccination rollouts, I think, have made traveling a lot easier, because it's a lot easier to get out there with vaccine passports than it has been without. And unfortunately, that's not the case in other parts of the world. And I know that, for example, Australia has only just opened its borders since closing it 2 years ago. So it's still early days, but certainly here in the UK, we're reaching kind of an endemic stage now with coronavirus. And I think the general view is that things are going to go back to some sort of a normal, of course, not the same as before the pandemic, but we're going to have to get used to the way things work. And if that means taking COVID tests, and then so be it. And I think travellers are willing to make that sacrifice by and large, so that they can get back out there again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you were able to have your trip. For people who are listening who don't know, tell us about the Halal Travel Guide, because I think it's something that it's a fantastic resource for a group of travelers. And it's the kind of thing that I think a lot of people maybe didn't have any idea existed, but nevertheless, it's a very helpful resource. Tell us about how you started it and what it does.
Yeah. So Halal Travel Guide was born really out of a road trip back in 2015. I was on my maternity leave, and me and my husband decided we'd go to Singapore and bring our four-month-old baby. So we hired a car, and from Singapore, we crossed the border into Johor Bahru, which is in Malaysia, and then continued to drive up north through the country. So we went through KL and Penang. And now at the time, Malaysia being a country with a significant population of Muslims, we kind of assumed that it would be quite easy to get our hands on good quality halal food. Generally speaking, Muslims, when they travel, they do struggle to find halal food, but Malaysia is one of those countries where you don't really anticipate to experience that struggle. And we were surprised to find that while we did access halal food relatively easy, it was actually quite hard to find the stuff where that the locals would eat at, you know, the places that the locals would actually go to, as opposed to the tourist spots where you get kind of dishes made with tourists in mind and probably aren't as authentic to the destination. So I started documenting the places that we went to, the experiences that we had, and I wanted just to make it easier for the next person to come along and have a higher quality experience. Because once you have knowledge that, you know, someone has already been there and they've had maybe a local to consult with, and they've got that, particularly the local advice and the local guidance, your trip really can go from being kind of a standard average experience to being much more high value. And I wanted to give that access to Muslims. So I started out really writing out tips for Muslim travelers on Malaysia and Singapore, and then continued that when we went to South Korea and Japan a couple of months later. South Korea being a destination that not many Muslim travelers would have typically gone to, because it's not necessarily a destination that would provide services that Muslims need, like halal food, for example. And again, in South Korea, actually, we were really pleasantly surprised, not only by the availability of halal food, but also how friendly locals were and how welcoming they were and hospitable. And really, that's what Halal Travel Guide is all about. It's about building bridges and making it easier for people to access experiences and to build connections and to experience cultures and to meet people that are otherwise quite hard to access.
Building bridges, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think food is one of the best ways to get to know people and the culture. And in fact, that's what gastro diplomacy is all about. So I guess you're a gastro diplomat.
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that, but I completely agree. I mean, even just kind of within your own kind of network with family and friends, food is a great way to bond and to heal rifts and to get to know people as well, especially if you're cooking a meal that's a family recipe or something that's traditional from back home. You know, it's these kind of experiences that open you up to another person and to another culture and build bridges that might not otherwise be that easy to build.
The World Food Travel Association is the world's leading authority on food and beverage tourism. Founded in 2001, each year we serve a community of 200,000 professionals in more than 150 countries. Need help to take your business or destination to the next level? Or are you looking for the latest trends and best practices from around the world? Look no further than our upcoming FoodTrex Global Summit. It's our largest annual event with delegates from dozens of countries. Visit worldfoodtravel.org and click on the Events tab to learn more and register. You know, I was surprised to hear what you said about Malaysia because I lived in Singapore and I was visiting Malaysia a couple times. And I remember I was at a resort on one of my trips there, and there were a group of Saudi travelers who were vacationing there. You noticed that, right? I asked where they were from, and they said Saudi Arabia. So that's how I know that. I would just assume, you know, being a Muslim country and getting Muslim tourists, I would expect there wouldn't be an issue. But you said it wasn't so easy. That's really interesting.
Like I said, we did access halal food, and that wasn't so much of a problem. Although I should say, actually, for anyone listening who is accessing halal food, you can't just assume in Malaysia that everything is halal, because of course there is a significant Chinese population. Pork is used, and for example, in a place like Penang, if you're going to a hawker's market, you do actually have to verify if the food that you're eating is halal. So it's not that straightforward. You can't assume that the food is always halal, and then. You know, I think this is a problem anywhere you go, whether you have dietary requirements or not, which is, yeah, you can access food, but where is the place that the locals will go to and eat at? Because those are the places, typically speaking, where you'll get the best quality food. And often as tourists, we go to the touristic spots because it's usually they're easier, maybe they're more accessible, and they're more visible online. I think one of the things that shocked me as I was traveling through Malaysia was there was hardly any information or resources online about where we could eat, or even activities or experiences that a young Muslim family might be interested in doing. And that's really where I wanted to fill the gap, because I thought, you know, we've come all this way. It's a 16-hour indirect flight. I want to enjoy a good meal and have a good time without feeling like I've had to trawl through loads of different websites and different resources to get access to that.
What did you consult before? Did you find resources like TripAdvisor helpful at all, or were there any other kinds of resources that you could use?
Well, my main issue was, and still is actually, is that the information is scattered on lots of different resources. TripAdvisor, it wasn't that helpful, I have to say. At the time, there was a new blog starting out, and I don't think it had actually started out. It's quite popular now, and it's based in, I think it's based in Singapore. That would have been really helpful at the time. And like me, they recognized that there was a gap in travel planning information designed with Muslim travelers in mind. And they've been really successful with it. They're called Have Halal with Travel. But I'm pretty sure that they only started out in September or a little bit later that year. So I wouldn't have had access to that resource either. So really, it was kind of tidbits here and there and speaking to locals. So we had an Airbnb host once. I remember speaking to her, asking people at places and little bits here and there. I think it would have been a lot easier if we'd had a local tour guide. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a huge advocate of having a local guide. It's one of the reasons why we have local guides on all of our trips at Halal Travel Guide, because just like you know your local area best, local guides are kind of even better in many ways because that's their specialty, and they're able to give you access to doors that you might not actually find that easy to open. I can give you a practical example of what I mean. So in Bosnia, we had the opportunity to curate a culinary experience for our guests, and it wasn't kind of in a restaurant, but it was really unique. It was in the countryside in a beautiful house that we rented. And our tour guide's mother, she grows vegetables and she's a very good cook. And she brought some of her own homegrown organic vegetables and hosted our guests for a traditional Balkan cooking session in the middle of the countryside in this beautiful property. And they were able to make stuffed peppers and Bosnian burek. And she didn't even speak English, they didn't speak Bosnian, but they really bonded over the whole experience of getting to know Bosnian culture, Bosnian traditions, and local Bosnians just through that culinary experience. That it was a very kind of homey environment, not something that you might otherwise get in different kind of settings. It's little things like this, I think, that can make a huge difference to the way that you experience a destination.
You know, you're absolutely right. The experience that you had in Bosnia is like one I had in Korea, where some colleagues arranged a transfer from the Seoul airport, and I was taken to the city of Daegu, which is about a 3-hour drive, 3-hour bus ride. Get there, you know, speaking no Korean, not even able to read the symbols or anything. I meet my contacts, they take me out to dinner. I don't speak Korean, they don't speak English, but we had a wonderful meal, and they could tell I was really enjoying myself because I wouldn't stop eating the tuna sashimi with sesame oil. And it was really kind of funny. I was making a bit of a pig of myself, but it was so delicious, and they were so pleased to see that. And you know, it was just a lovely experience. But what you were saying about the tourist guides, you're absolutely right. If someone doesn't have a local contact that they can rely on, like we both had, then a tourist guide is your next best resource because they will open up the nuances of a destination unlike any other possible situation. I mean, can you imagine just going around in a city in an Uber or in the subway or something and trying to get the gist of the city, especially in a language or alphabet that you don't
Yeah,
understand.
this is it. I mean, I've done it. We made that mistake when we went to Korea as well. And we were very young. We were a bit broke, to be honest. I think we ran out of money like twice in Malaysia. So we were super young. We didn't really know what we were doing. And in South Korea as well, we did stay in a hostel, so we did kind of have that access to a local taking us, giving us recommendations. But we didn't really have anyone to take us around or show us places. And I do think it does dilute the experience that you give yourself. And I just think if you're going all that way, you're already spending X amount of money on your trip. Why not just go that one step further and invest? If you don't have a local friend or a relative or someone to take you around, get a tour guide because it makes the experience so much more enjoyable. And I have to second what you said about Korean food, Eric. Korean food is amazing.
Well, I'm glad that you had a great experience there as well. And I have not been to Bosnia, but I work with a web developer in Serbia, and which is right next door. And I've seen some of their foods showcased in different things. We work with the World Federation of Tourist Guide Associations, and they were doing an event in Serbia, and they were promoting it, and they were showcasing some of the pictures of the food, and all of the pictures were desserts.
Oh, interesting.
And
Okay.
I shared that with my web developer, and he said, "Oh, yeah, well, this isn't the most healthy representation of our food culture, but yes, they're all really tasty."
That's really interesting. I mean, Bosnia is not huge on desserts, I have to say. And I haven't been to Serbia yet, so I don't know what the difference is between the food. I imagine it's somewhat different because there's more of an Ottoman influence in Bosnia than there is in Serbia. And of course, we know that the Ottomans brought their food with them wherever they went, but also you'd have local variations and influences on those particular dishes. So Bosnia is a very meat-heavy country for sure. They love kind of grilled meat, not so huge on desserts. There is one dessert that's really nice, and I guess you could say is quite iconic, which is called tufahia, and it's basically like a poached apple stuffed with crushed walnuts. And then it's soaked in a syrup, and then there's usually kind of like a swirl of cream on the top. And that's really nice, but it's not very sweet. They also do really nice homemade ice creams in the Baštaršija, which is in Sarajevo. So you'll get loads of ice cream vendors. And I don't really like ice cream that much, but there's something about the ice cream in Bosnia. If anyone is there or planning to go, you really need to try the ice cream. It's super good.
Well, ice cream is always the correct choice as far as I'm concerned. I'd like to talk more about Bosnia because when I was researching a little bit more, digging deeper into your background, and I learned that you had done some work in Bosnia, and really there's something quite remarkable about your experience there. Would you mind sharing with our listeners what that was?
Bosnia has a really special place in my heart. It's one of those places where you need to go to really experience it. And I hope, Eric, that we can host you there in the future, to be honest,
I'd
especially
love
since you
it.
haven't been.
Yeah.
It's the first place that we ever hosted a halal travel guide trip. And in some ways, it kind of came about by accident because I never really intended, honestly, for halal travel guide to become a kind of a service that would take people to places. The idea initially was always we'll provide the information and then you do the trip. And it was after I went to Bosnia and I had a local tour guide. We had an amazing time. And I met up with him a few months later in London and he said, "Why don't you bring a group to Bosnia? I'll help you out with the logistics. You can curate the itinerary according to what you think your audience will like. We'll work together. And we'll bring people to experience Bosnia." And at the time, I was sort of incredulous. I was like, well, I've never done something like this before. I don't know anything about hosting guests or taking people on a trip. But for some reason, I said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And 6 months later, we had our first ever group trip to Bosnia. And to this day, that group is called the best group ever because the experience was just so magical. And I think that we've been really blessed in terms of having the most amazing local guides and local hosts, chefs to work with. But also, Bosnia has this magical combination of fantastic scenery, really rich heritage. I mean, I know most people remember Bosnia because of the war, but it's got such a rich heritage that is just waiting to be explored. And then really high quality hospitality as well, super friendly, very welcoming, you know, non-judgmental people, like come as you are type mentality, amazing food as well. So it's got so much to offer. And I think, unfortunately, it hasn't really benefited from tourism in the way that many of its neighbors have. And there's, you know, lots of different reasons for that. And that's one of the things that I've been working on over the last few years, is to show people that Bosnia is such an incredible place to visit. You know, you can do all sorts of things. You can go rafting on the coldest river in the world. You can go hiking. You can explore heritage that dates back several centuries. And you can do all of that and be hosted by really friendly people that will make you want to come back again and again and again.
I think you're absolutely right. I would say that that part of the Balkan Peninsula is a bit of a desert of culinary tourism, because you've got Bosnia, Serbia, North Macedonia, Albania, and none of those countries are really known for anything about their food or beverage culture. But then if you turn immediately over to Croatia or Slovenia or Romania or Bulgaria or Greece, of course, people can pretty much articulate something about those food or beverage products from those countries. But in that particular part of the Balkan Peninsula, there's is just this kind of desert. I don't think anyone really knows what happens there.
Yeah, which is strange, because the culinary tradition in Bosnia is really rich and varied. Like the street food, for example, if you are in Sarajevo, the capital, and you need to head into the Bastarcia, and the Bastarcia is the old town, basically, the old Ottoman center, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's like an open-air walking museum. They've preserved all the traditional architecture, but built in modern-day shops and cafes and this kind of thing. So it's really gorgeous, and you can go there. And firstly, it's really good value for money. I'd say one of the first things you should try is a burek. Similarly, you have burek in a lot of Ottoman or kind of ex-Ottoman lands. It's a pastry usually stuffed with meat or cheese or spinach or potato. But the Bosnian version is soft and flaky as opposed to being crunchy. And then you want to try a drink that they have, which is called Zova, which is like an elderflower type cordial. Amazing drink, super fresh. And actually, one of Bosnia's greatest strengths is that it's a very fertile land. They grow pomegranates. They grow all sorts of lovely produce, actually, and you see it in the food. A lot of the meat is sourced locally, the vegetables are sourced locally. One of the experiences that we have in our trips is that we stop in the mountains and visit a local family who produce a homemade meal for us and for our guests. Berries are literally squeezed and are grown, squeezed and pressed by the same person. They come from the garden, and it's literally farm to table. And it's one of those places where you can have all the mod cons of modern day and Wi-Fi and all that sort of thing, but you can also still have that very close to earth experience. And yeah, I think it's just another reason why people keep coming back to Bosnia. I mean, another thing I love about it is that there are water fountains everywhere you go. So it's a great place to stop wasting plastic. So one of the things we're trying to do is cut down on our plastic waste. And of course, water bottles is one of the biggest causes of plastic waste on trips, because people often feel worried about the water they're consuming in foreign countries. But Bosnia has these Ottoman-era water fountains nearly everywhere you go. And the water is very high quality. It's drinking water that the locals will use. And, you know, I personally drink from it each time. It's just another great symbol of how hospitable Bosnians are, and how you see that through the food and through the beverage and through the customs that they have.
That's fantastic. Well, you definitely sold me. It almost sounds like Europe's best kept secret when it comes to what we could discover there. And you hit a little bit on the sustainability issue, and I'm glad that you did, because that is so timely. Everyone in culinary tourism, whether it's a food and beverage company or a travel and hospitality company, everyone has to be concerned about it. I think that you, when we were talking before the show, you were talking about food waste being one of your biggest concerns for our industry.
Sustainability, it's about time that it became a core part of travel and tourism. And of course, food is an essential part of travel and tourism, and food waste, unfortunately, as a byproduct. And we see in certain touristic settings where there is proportionally more food waste. So, for example, cruises, resorts, where unfortunately, you know, where you get like an all-day buffet, there is more likely to be food waste. And if that can be countered by engaging in a local program where the food that is not eaten at the end of the day will then go somewhere else, and that's great. But I think it's about working with locals to find out what they have traditionally done, because generally speaking, locals do have mechanisms for food waste, whether it's composting, whether it's redistributing, whether it's using it for something else, and then and building that on a greater scale. So something as simple as, I know, for example, in some destinations, coconut shells or coconut rusks, instead of being thrown away, are then repurposed and polished and sold for not an inconsiderable price as bowls. And it's like a bougie thing as well. That's pretty popular for people interested in how their kitchen looks and this kind of thing. But these are completely recycled and natural products that are hugely valuable and again help to minimize food waste. So I think if we always look at what the locals are doing and find out what the local wisdom is first, and then work at integrating that with digital solutions that will allow us to scale up, whether it's through an app, for example, whether it's through a service that allows a restaurant or a hotel to inform a distributor, hey, we've got X amount of food left over, and then they come and pick it up and they redistribute it, or they take it to a food bank, or it's used as compost for growing local fruits and vegetables. Once we kind of engage in that conversation a bit more deeply with locals, we'll start to make much better headway than perhaps we have currently done.
I agree with you. And in fact, this notion of food waste is so concerning to us that we created a, well, we've just introduced new practice areas here at the association, and sustainability is one of the practice areas. And the whole purpose of us looking at this is to see how sustainability interacts with food and beverage tourism. And it's no secret that food-loving travelers, I mean, you mentioned the water bottles before, that's one thing, but plastic cutlery, plastic straws, the packaging. Do you really need a carrier bag? All of those kinds of things. When we travel and we consume food, we generate an enormous amount of waste. And maybe in the past few years, people thought, well, you know, I'm the traveler, I'm spending the money, and it's my right to leave this garbage behind. But I don't think people can behave like that anymore. And I think destinations need to make it easy as well for travelers to know what to do when it comes to recycling certain products.
Yeah, I mean, some of the challenges are that the facilities just aren't there. Like, most hotel rooms will not have a recycling bin for you to put your water bottles or, you know, your plastic products. And I think part of the problem around that is, okay, it's going to be quite expensive, but then we need to start thinking about ourselves as consumers, as travelers, how we can minimize our output of this waste from the get-go, rather than waiting for destinations and hotels and organizations to make those changes. And I think it's a lot of it is about raising awareness. I think you're right in that traditionally speaking, travelers have been spoken to in such a way that we think, you know, I'm on holiday, I spent money, I should be able to do things the way that I like to without having to inconvenience myself. But unfortunately, a lot of the time, it means that there is a really a negative impact on the destination and the local people that live there as a result. And it's really sad because tourism has the opportunity to do the opposite. You can bring a lot of good when you bring an informed traveler to a destination who knows exactly what they need to do to help protect and preserve the environment, and then who's also able to have a higher value experience by connecting more deeply with that destination, whether it's through interacting with the locals or trying out the traditional food or exploring the traditional customs. And I think sustainability really has to link in with this idea of conscious traveling, of intentional traveling, and showing travelers that, yes, it's your holiday, your trip, but my goodness, you'll have a much better experience if you interact with the locals and then therefore start to value that destination and the local people much more, and therefore care a lot more about how your visit impacts them. Because if we don't have that connection, it's a lot easier to just forget about it and think, oh, you know, like, I don't know the people anyway, and I probably won't come back here, so I'll be able to let that one go. But once we build those deeper relationships, I think people will be a lot more mindful about how their trips are impacting people when they visit them.
You know, I had an experience like that. I went to Nepal a few years ago. We produced our Food Trek's Nepal Summit, and some of the nicest people on the planet, just super kind people, beautiful country. Obviously, the mountains are fascinating, really interesting food culture. But while I was there, the plastic bottles and wrapping and stuff, no one was doing anything with it. And I would take the bottle, the used water bottle with me around, looking for a bin to put it in. I never found one. And I asked our ambassador there, I said, where do I put this? And he said, oh, well, the trash can's right over there. I said, no, well, where's the recycling bin? And he says, oh, well, we don't recycle in Nepal. And I said, what? You're kidding me. I mean, a country that's kind of iconic for adventure travel and, yeah. and eco everything, and you don't recycle? And he goes, no, there's no recycling facilities in the country. And I thought, wow, how did that happen? And I felt almost like I was cheated, right? A little bit. You know, here, you got me to come to Nepal and I'm excited to be here. And now I can't do the right thing because you don't have the facilities in place. It was a strange experience. And I took all my plastic back with me to the UK.
Oh, wow. Oh, I rate that a lot. But you know, Eric, unfortunately, it's a lot more common than I think those of us in travel and tourism care to admit. The amount of times I've been to destinations, just for example, in Tunisia, in Algeria as well, you'll go to like the old Medina in the center. It's absolutely gorgeous, really well preserved. And then literally right outside it, there's a tree with loads of plastic bags just dumped by the tree because there's no real awareness of what to do with that kind of rubbish. And there aren't really the facilities available for people to dispose of them properly. I know in Barbados, they've started a new venture. And I saw it myself, and I think it's really admirable in that certainly the hotel that we stayed in, and I think all hotels on the island now, A, have to have recycling facilities, so you have a recycling bin in your room, but also when we ate out at restaurants, because most places are still using disposable cutlery because of COVID, the disposable cutlery that we were using and the packaging as well is all compostable. I don't know what it's made from, but I was really impressed, and I was told actually that this is a new rule and that you're not allowed single-use plastic now at restaurants. It has to be something that is compostable and basically doesn't stay on the planet for hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think further than that, I think we just have to start making that shift away from single-use plastics. You know, like those little bottles that you get in hotel bathrooms. I don't know, do people even use those shampoos anymore? Because most of the time they really ruin your hair and, you know, the products, I think these are things that aren't really needed. And you can get soap bars now that you can take with you rather than carrying your like a massive bottle of shampoo. It's possible now to get shampoo in a bar. You know, I think it's just about being more conscious about how we purchase day-to-day items. And I think a lot of it is making those choices at home before we travel as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that when we talk about sustainability, we look at not just the environmental aspect, but the economic and the sociocultural aspect as well. And I think everybody focuses on the environmental the most because it's the thing that you see the most, right? You see the plastic on the beaches and on the ocean and the stomachs of marine life and so on. But I think that we could connect this into the economic sustainability as well. If we turned this, not we, but if countries turned this into a business where people could actually earn money from collecting garbage that could then be recycled. So you were talking about the tree in Tunisia where all the plastic bags were located. I had a similar experience in Jordan. We were working there a few years ago, and these black carrier bags were in fences. The wind had blown them into fences throughout the country. And we'd be going along, and there'd be the Dead Sea, or we're on our way to Petra or Wadi Rum. And then all of a sudden, you know, you just see all these black bags. And I had a really hard time concentrating on the scenery because I was so concerned about the black bags. But what if we turned this into a win and we actually employ people to go around, pick up, and then they could be rewarded for their efforts as a job?
I love the idea. And I think it's already been implemented in some places, but it's not that well heard of. Because I remember having a conversation with a lady in Istanbul. She was from Malaysia. And she was telling me about how she runs, I believe it was like a boarding school or something of the sort. I don't think it was an orphanage. I think it was a boarding school. And she developed this program where the students would essentially collect rubbish and then they would sell that rubbish off to a facility that would then recycle it. So they made money from it. They helped clear up their local areas. And a company was able to then do more with it. And I don't know the details of what was done with it, but I think you're absolutely right. I think it's just, I guess, someone taking that first step.
You know, you hit on something really interesting there, the notion of teaching entrepreneurism to younger people.
Yeah.
I think that is something that could be really valuable in societies today. And they don't do that. You're taught general studies. And then if you excel in an area like mathematics or languages or whatever, you're pushed down that path. But no one ever really trains you how to be an entrepreneur. And so many small businesses are one or two people shops now.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that the kind of education system isn't really geared around being creative or being critical thinkers so much, which is what you need to be an entrepreneur. Certainly, I've got two young children. I really want my children to start their business projects while they're young, ideally under 10, so that they know that they can try, and if they fail, that's fine, they can try again. But also to do so with kind of social entrepreneurship in mind, and that's at the heart of Halal Travel Guide, which is about offering a service. Yes, you're a company, hopefully you're making money, you're turning over a profit, you're employing people, that's all great, but offering a service or a product that really adds value to people's lives, and helps them to feel like their lives have improved, even if it's just by 1%, as the consumer, as the customer, as the traveler, but also people on the other side of the spectrum, the people that are your suppliers, the people that are your service providers, also benefiting, not just financially, but also in deeper ways, where, for example, one of our big things is making sure that the tickets paid by our customers circulate within the local economy. So when we went to Barbados, we didn't stay in a resort, we stayed in a hotel. And every day we had different activities organized so that A, our guests would have a range of experiences of Barbados. So yes, you've got the sun, sea, sand, it's gorgeous, absolutely amazing. And then you also learn about the heritage, you learn about the slavery, you learn about plantations. Then you also connect with the local people. There's a local Muslim community that has lived there for about 100 years and is not very well known about. Then we also went to Cocoa Hill Forest and explored one of the last remaining rainforests in Barbados because unfortunately a lot of it was cut down to make way for sugarcane. Helping out by paying tickets at all these different places so that the money is spread out and so that the local economy and the local people really feel the benefit of travelers coming to their destination rather than it all being pulled into one place. And sometimes, unfortunately, that company or that destination, sorry, that resort, whatever it is, might even be internationally owned. So, unfortunately, locals barely see any result from it. So, this is the kind of mentality that I'd really like to instill in my children, which is that you can make money, but you can also make money by really adding value to people's lives and minimizing the negative impacts that will come out of any kind of entrepreneurship.
Samaya, I think we've solved a lot of the world's issues right now
I know it sounds easier said than
on
done.
this podcast episode. There's so many things that we've touched on, and I think and they're all really interesting and important topics. But thinking back to a point earlier in your life, if you had to advise a younger you, what would you tell yourself as a younger person?
I would tell myself to dream better. I think a lot of us, I think dreaming is an art. And not everyone can dream because of their circumstances, and not everyone knows how to dream. And it's really important, I think, as someone who probably didn't have proper dreams growing up. I think I was always good at school, ticked all the boxes academically. Actually, I always excelled, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And I distinctly remember feeling like I want to do something that is good, that helps people. I didn't want to work in the charitable sector. I knew that. And I didn't necessarily want to be a volunteer all my life, but I knew that I wanted to do something that would bring benefit to people. And I really didn't know what that could be. And I think perhaps maybe my limitations in what I thought I could do, what I thought was possible, meant that maybe I got a, it took me a little while longer than it could have done to get where I am today. And I'm not saying that as a criticism of my journey, because I think all of it has been really important to get where I am now. But I think a lot of people would think, things like maybe being married or having children would be barriers to being an entrepreneur, barriers to traveling, perhaps. And actually, I think my personal experiences have really helped to propel me forward and to inspire me to work harder so that whatever I'm doing, I am giving value to my loved ones, I'm giving value to my community, and hopefully to wider society.
So you could have been a beneficiary of that young entrepreneur training then if it was offered when you were a young girl in school.
Oh, definitely. I think one of the challenges as well at the time is there weren't very many people that looked like me kind of on the entrepreneurial stage. I didn't really know any entrepreneurs. You have to be able to visualize yourself in that position, I think. And if you don't visualize that yourself there, then you've almost hamstringed yourself from the start.
Indeed. Is there a legacy that you hope to leave behind?
That is a good question. I think the legacy that I hope to leave behind for my children, for the people that I come into contact with, is that there is a way that you can do business that benefits everyone that you've come into contact with. And specifically for Halal Travel Guide, I hope that the legacy that we leave behind is that we build bridges for people from different walks of life, impregnable bridges between people and stories and cultures that have otherwise been disconnected and are otherwise quite hard to bring together.
Well, what better way to do that than through food and drink and sitting down around a table with someone new?
Absolutely. I really agree 100%.
Do you have a quote that you're known for?
Okay. By known for, I'd say this is between me and my husband, which is the phrase pitiful contribution. And it's perhaps one of my weaknesses in that whenever I reach a goalpost or I reach a milestone, instead of celebrating it properly and acknowledging it properly, I'm like, okay, now it's time to move the goalposts even further. I'm not satisfied. I need to reach the next step. We need to be doing more. And there is always more that you can do. And, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with this feeling, Eric, that you always feel like there's more that you should be doing. But I think it's really important, whatever you're doing in life, to acknowledge your achievements, to write them down so that you can actually visualize them. And so that in a few months or a few years, you look at them and think, you know what, actually, I've come far. And that's something to be celebrated. And sometimes it's just the small things, but it's a really important process that I, for one, definitely need to implement a lot more.
Last question, where do you look forward to traveling to next for food or drink experiences?
I mean, there's quite a few places. There are a couple of places that I'm actually going to that I'm looking forward to experiencing. One of them is Uzbekistan. I've been to Uzbekistan before, and we're taking another group there this March, hopefully. And Uzbek food and Central Asian food is absolutely phenomenal. And actually is another one that hasn't quite made it reputation-wise, I guess, on the gastro scene. But it should, because it's absolutely fantastic. And in Uzbekistan, you can experience Uzbek food, Uyghur food, Chinese food, Russian food, and all of it. It's absolutely amazing. So I'm really looking forward to going to Uzbekistan, and hopefully I'll be doing a little food tour as well and sharing that with our audience. But one place that I definitely like to try the food is the Philippines. And I know that last year in the Philippines, the tourism board started promoting Mindanao cuisine. And in Mindanao, there's a Muslim community there. And of course, it means the food is halal and that I can eat it to my heart's content. And I'd love to be able to explore Philippine culture through that type of cuisine. So that's definitely something that I hope one day I'll be able to do.
That sounds like a great plan. We have a new ambassador from the Philippines, and she talks a lot about the food. And we just did a Taste of Place report on the Philippines as well. And the food looks phenomenal. And they're supposed to have amazing beaches. And she has also promised me that they are the best mangoes on the planet. They're much better than any other mango I've ever had. So I have to reserve judgment for trying a true Filipino mango on site.
Oh, wow. I know that countries and people get very protective over the status of their mangoes. So I definitely want to hear what your experience is like when you try one.
Indeed. Well, Sumaya, it's been a true pleasure. I always cherish our conversations, and I still look forward to the time when we can meet in person in London and share a meal together in person and get to know each other even better. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge today.
It's my pleasure, Eric. Honestly, I really enjoy our conversations. And I really hope, like I said earlier, that we can host you in Bosnia. And if not Bosnia, then by all means, come to London and I will cook you a traditional Algerian meal.
Oh, wow. That sounds amazing. But Bosnia sounds good too. So
we look forward to it.
We'll see you soon, Sumaya. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Take care.
That's it for this episode of the Eat Well, Travel Better podcast. This episode is brought to you by the World Food Travel Association. The World Food Travel Association is the world's leading authority on food and beverage tourism. Founded in 2001, each year we serve a community of 200,000 professionals in more than 150 countries. Thinking about a career change because of the pandemic, or looking to improve your current skills? Consider our bespoke training and certification programs in culinary tourist guiding, culinary tour operations, restaurant and food service, and culinary destination marketing. Visit academy.worldfoodtravel.org to learn more and get started. Finally, we'd like to hear from you regarding the podcast. We invite you to share your ideas, questions, and thoughts by emailing us at help@worldfoodtravel.org. or you can connect with us and comment about the episode on major social media platforms. Special thanks to our guest, Sumaya Hamdi, and thank you for joining us. I'm Eric Wolf, wishing you a safe, happy, and productive month ahead.